We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
The concern at the moment is getting help to the survivors and also people who are still trapped in some areas. They can't get out of their houses. So, you know, the focus is on search and rescue.
The voice of Patrick Fuller with the International Federation of the Red Cross speaking from Tokyo. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us, as he does most Saturdays, this week from Beijing. And Jim, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Guy. Nice to talk to you.
And Jim, of course, we begin with a disaster in Japan, a place you know well as a former correspondent there.
Yes, and of course, my heart does go out to Japan and the consequences they're going through now. There's been a lot of attention, as there should be, to the preparations Japan has made over the years and the things it's learned from past earthquake disasters and the way that has reduced the carnage the country is now going through. I'm here to say that having lived there, it's almost hard to imagine the degree of preparation that Japanese institutions and people make. For example, when my kids went to Japanese public school, they had to wear these little earthquake hoods to school. They're kind of like little Darth Vader padded caps. They'd had monthly earthquake drills. Something that struck me is that in real time, we were seeing these helicopter shots of the tsunami just working its devastating way across the countryside. Those helicopters were available and on call to be marshaled. And the contrast was so great with what happened in China 3 years ago after the Sichuan earthquake, where many people perished just because there was no rescue equipment to get there. And this contrast is now being very much dwelled upon in the Chinese press, where people are saying, look how well prepared the Japanese are, and contrasting it to the situation here.
What kind of economic impact could this have, not just on Japan, but on the world?
I think the second stage coverage of this disaster is largely going to involve some of these economic ripple effects. Even though so many products that we see now, of course, are made in China, many of their components actually come from Japan. For example, there was a recent study of the iPad, which is made in China, but roughly 10 times as much of its value comes from Japanese suppliers as from Chinese firms. And so if the supplies there are cut off, that's an issue. If there are disruptions of the factories or of the shipment system, suddenly you can have effects on the worldwide supply. Chains. And there have been examples of this in the past. Mm.
Jim, Japan, of course, is the third largest nuclear power user in the world. A lot of concern about some of those reactors. I am assuming this has got to be a setback for some of the assumptions we've all made about the safety of these reactors.
Certainly, there's going to be a long-term impact on how long it will take for these reactors to get back in line and new ones to be built around the world. It's striking how much of the history of the peaceful nuclear power industry has been dominated by two incidents. One, Three Mile Island, of course, in the U.S., the other, Chernobyl, and then the Soviet Union in 1986. And so a question for whether nuclear power plays a larger or smaller role in the world's energy balance, I think, is whether the Fukushima nuclear plants have that same kind of iconic and dangerous significance, and we just don't know that yet.
That's James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com, which I should add shamelessly that I will be contributing to as a guest next week. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy, and thank you so much for your help on the blog.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. There is only one protagonist in Ellen Meister's new novel, but there are two plots. Quinn Braverman is a pregnant suburban mother of a 6-year-old boy and wife of a down-to-earth guy who owns a fleet of taxis. Quinn is also a single girlfriend of a needy shock jock who lives in a high-rise apartment in Manhattan. And the thing is, she lives both lives simultaneously and can switch between the two. The book is called The Other Life, and its author, Ellen Meister, is in NPR's New York studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Leanne.
Quinn has access to a portal in her basement laundry room. Explain the premise of her parallel lives.
Well, what happened with Quinn when she was a baby, something happened, and it's explained in the book, that split her life in two. And growing up, she was aware that every time she made a major life decision, another life existed in which she made the opposite choice. Now, there are portals between the two lives. She's very much aware of them. She's actually come close and touched and brushed against the other side, but she's never been tempted to slip through and go from one life to the other until something fairly large happens in her life that causes enough stress for her to want to see what's there on the other side.
There's a scene on page 193 of the book. It's in chapter 21, and Quinn is in a terrible state of mind because in one life, her mother's alive, and in the other life, her mother has committed suicide. Would you begin where Quinn is in the laundry and The paragraph begins, "She knocked the basket of clothes onto the floor."
My pleasure. Thanks, Leanne. "She knocked the basket of clothes onto the floor and kicked it. It felt good to unleash her anger. But she needed something more. If her strength had matched her fury, she would have ripped the washer from the plumbing and hurled it away. She would have pulled the cabinets off the walls and smashed them to pieces. She would have kicked holes in the drywall and smashed the lights. She was as infuriated with her own impotence as she was with her mother. She knew it wasn't Nan's fault that her brother was in the hospital and that her baby was damaged. But damn it, she should be there to help her through." Quinn stood in the center of the room, panting and sweating. Was there no outlet for this rage? No outlet for a woman whose mother had made the most selfish decision of all? There was, of course. There was one perfect outlet, and Quinn knew it. At last, she pulled open the ancient ironing board and crossed through to the other life.
That's Ellen Meister reading a section of her book, The Other Life. First of all, about portals, are you a science fiction fan? Why did this interest you?
You know, it never occurred to me as science fiction. I got the idea because I was just sitting home one day, typical moment where the husband had left for work, the kids had left for school, and I was thinking about the fact that when I'm alone in the house during those precious few hours, I get to escape into this world of fiction that I created. And I was focusing on that and concentrating on that, and a strange thought occurred to me, and I said, what if a woman had the ultimate escape, the ability to actually slip through a portal to the life she would have had if she'd made completely different choices? It didn't occur to me as science fiction. It occurred to me as just this very, very powerful what if. And in fact, I immediately pictured the portal in the most domestic scene you can imagine, you know, right behind an ironing board in her basement. In fact, in the foundation of her house, which seemed a really neat metaphor to me.
Hmm. And so you had no knowledge of quantum physics and no knowledge of, say, the string theorist Brian Greene's contention that there are actually parallel universes in different dimensions.
When I wrote the book, no, I had never heard of it. I didn't know that there are quantum physicists who theorize that actually every possibility in the universe actually exists. I learned about that only after I had written the book. And I said, look at that. I just, you know, stumbled onto quantum physics.
Hmm. Does some of this book come from your own life? I mean, you live in the Long Island and you've got three kids. You don't drive a Volvo, you drive a minivan. But
that's
in some
right.
respects...
Well, in some respects, of course, while there might not be actual facts lifted from my life, what I try to do as an author is take emotional truths and put them in fictional scenarios. Mm-hmm. So, yes, in that sense, they're pieces of my life and the way I feel about a mother, the way I feel about a relationship, the way I feel about children, that's, I hope, is all in there.
Were you concerned at all that this whole portal thing would be a gimmick, that it would turn into, I mean, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the Twilight Zone episode. Where you do remember that?
Of
where
course,
the physicist
sure.
drew on the wall and
right.
the portal? Yeah. Were you
yeah.
concerned, though, that the device would get too gimmicky?
That was a very, very tricky thing to navigate with the book. Once I had all these ideas, I sat down, I said, let me see how I can make this work and make it not feel like science fiction, and not even really feel paranormal, but just this sort of strange magical realism within a very grounded story.
I think you said it, magical realism. That's not a phrase I've heard in a while, but of course it's a great tradition in literature.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that when I came up with the idea, I didn't say to myself, I'd love to write a magical realism book. I got the idea and I said, that's the tone that I want to get with this book. I really just wanted to explore this woman and her two lives and her choices.
This is a novel that takes the reader right up to the last sentence of the book, and you leave a lot of things unresolved, which in some ways is satisfying but also frustrating. Did you leave it open-ended for another book?
No, I didn't leave it open-ended for another book. What was important to me wasn't what happened so much as what Quinn's decision was. That was where I wanted to leave the reader. And I thought that by ending it where I did, it made that point. What was critical was where she got to and what decision she made. And as far as what happens after that, it wasn't as important as the decision.
I get the feeling that you really love this character, Quinn Braverman. I mean, she really got under your skin.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I love authors who not only explore the relationship between people in a fresh, invigorating, and exciting and insightful way. But when an author's affection for their characters feels like it goes straight from the pages to my heart, that's a book that I will really fall in love with. So I take that as a big compliment. Thank you.
Ellen Meister's new novel, The Other Life, has just been published, and she joined us from the NPR studio in New York. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. The writer James Carroll first visited Jerusalem as a young Catholic priest back in 1973, and since then he's been back dozens of times. And James Carroll, like a lot of people who know Jerusalem, has a kind of two-sided relationship with the city. It's a place that can inspire and also disappoint. The city of peace, but also, as he describes it, the home base of religious violence. Carroll's written about these two sides of Jerusalem in a new book. It's called appropriately Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And James Carroll joins me from WBUR in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to start by asking you about your first trip to Jerusalem in 1973. What were you looking for at the time?
Well, the short of it is my life was kind of a mess. I was a young Catholic priest, having grown up the son of an American Air Force officer. Through the 1960s, early 70s, my life had been upended by direct experience of the dread of nuclear war, the war in Vietnam. I was a member of the Catholic left, the so-called Catholic peace movement, brought about a lot of conflict, not only with my dad, but with established authority in general, which left me a bit adrift as a priest. And I went to Jerusalem, not sure why, presented itself as a kind of drawing magnet to me. And in Jerusalem, I was shocked to discover it was itself a kind of mess. I encountered in ways I hadn't before the very real, tangible, sacramental presence of God. And it was a kind of threshold for the rest of my life.
You say you caught Jerusalem fever on that trip. Can you explain that phenomenon?
Jerusalem fever is the temptation to use the city of Jerusalem as a screen on which to project all kinds of millennial, end-of-the-world fantasies. It's been certainly a Christian habit of mind. You see it powerfully in the book of Revelation. But every group that's had a relationship to Jerusalem has done this. The Jewish fantasy of Jerusalem kept Jews in exile and in diaspora a coherent and cohesive people down through the centuries. The Islamic fantasy brought Islamic armies to the gates of Jerusalem within 5 years of the prophet's death. Even today, the United States of America defines itself as the city on a hill, which an inch below the surface of our rhetoric is Jerusalem. So Jerusalem fever is this feeling that a particular place has been touched by God and therefore almost trans-historical consequences are set in motion.
James Carroll, this book, of course, is also a history of the city in Jerusalem. There is no river, there's no port or sea, just hills on the edge of the Judean desert. Why this city? Why this place? Why was it there?
It's a hilltop city, which is part of the answer, no doubt. It's a city on the edge of the Fertile Crescent, the crossroads where our civilization was born, the great crossroads of the ancient world. All the empires of the ancient world came into conflict with each other there or near there. And savage violence found a home in Jerusalem. And that's the point. It was in resisting that violence that the people of Jerusalem invented a new religion, monotheistic Judaism. They invented a book which records the struggle against violence. People complain that the Bible is full of violence, but that's missing the point. Of course it is, because the Bible's subject is violence. And in Jerusalem, people have found ways to mitigate violence. The story of Abraham and Isaac is a classic example, God saying no to human sacrifice. They have found ways to surpass the violent impulse. Jesus of Nazareth, remembered above all as a person of nonviolence. And right into the sort of centuries of Western civilization, Crusader violence became a note of Jerusalem. The war between Europe and Islam, now 1,000 years old, centered on Jerusalem. And we're still trying to find ways to reckon with that. And yet the history of the place tells us that violence can be reckoned with and can be directly confronted and can be left behind. That's the hope of Jerusalem that I'm trying to lift up with this book.
I lived there as a reporter for 2 years, and I think anyone who does live there is really taken in by the city. It is beautiful and inspiring, and history is all around you. Yet it's a difficult place to be. I mean, it's tense, it's polarized, it's political.
It's a cockpit. It's an historical cockpit. There's nothing comfortable about it. It's a mess. And, of course, what I eventually understood, both as a young man in visiting Jerusalem and then down through the years as I've gone there most years, is that it's precisely its messiness that is the point. Speaking religiously, God comes to us exactly in the mess of our lives. God doesn't come to us in a pristine garden. And it's in the conflict of Jerusalem that religious meaning has to be found. It was out of the terrible Roman destruction of Jerusalem that rabbinic Judaism understood the meaning of Israel in a new way. It was out of that same destruction that the people of Jesus understood themselves as the church. There's a version of this experience that belongs to Islam, and there's a version of it that belongs to Western civilization.
I'm speaking with the author James Carroll. His new book is called Jerusalem, Jerusalem. It's hard to write about Jerusalem or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict without being accused of having a political agenda, as you know. But I found that in this book you write with a great deal of empathy for both Israelis and Palestinians. And it seems that you genuinely, I mean, you've gone there many times. You've been to Jerusalem many times. You have friends, I'm assuming, all over the place.
Yes.
Is it a struggle for you to write with empathy about both communities?
Well, the story of Jerusalem is many stories, and my hope in this book was that I would be able to relate the narratives of various peoples respectfully, and my purpose was to relate the narratives in a way that both peoples could recognize themselves, recognize their story. It goes to the larger point, which is that peace comes about when one party recognizes the narrative of an antagonistic party and sees its point. Peace presumes the capacity to enter in some way into the experience of the other.
That's James Carroll. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University. His latest book is called Jerusalem, Jerusalem. James Carroll, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm honored to have been with you.